Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday the 6th of July, these are our main stories. Britain's new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has appointed his senior government team after the centre-left Labour Party swept to power in Thursday's general election. Joe Biden has told a campaign event that he's fit and ready to stay in the presidential race, days after his lacklustre performance in the US presidential debate with Donald Trump. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has held talks with Vladimir Putin in Moscow on a visit that's drawn sharp criticism from other European leaders. Also in this podcast, after the recent violence surrounding the youth-led protests in Kenya...
I took a long time before coming to X. I think I should be more often in this X space to engage with... You guys, and to deal with the situation there.
The president goes on social media. Will it help? We begin in the UK. Hours after his Labour Party was swept to office with a massive electoral majority, Britain's new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has assembled his senior government team. His aim, he told supporters, was to rebuild Britain and restore trust in politics, although he warned this would take time.
Whether you voted Labour or not, in fact, especially if you did not, I say to you directly, my government will serve you. Politics can be a force for good. We will show that. We've changed the Labour Party, returned it to service, and that is how we will govern. Country first, party second.
Labour has a majority of more than 170, ending 14 years of often turbulent Conservative government. Keir Starmer began on Friday afternoon taking up the reins of government by welcoming colleagues to Downing Street and appointing his cabinet. Their task is to convert the promises of the campaign into action. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zerfman, looks at the future direction of this new government.
Our work is urgent and we begin it today. Those were the last words of Sir Keir Starmer's first speech as Prime Minister. First off, Sir Keir, like every Prime Minister, will have been asked to write his letters of last resort, handwritten instructions for the commanders of Britain's nuclear submarines. Then, a little more prosaically, appointing his first cabinet, inviting the key figures to Downing Street. Here the Prime Minister was in no-drama Starmer mode. The last Labour Prime Minister to win from opposition, Tony Blair, shuffled his lieutenants around. Not so for Sir Keir. Almost every senior member of his shadow cabinet will sit around the real cabinet table in the same portfolio. Angela Rayner is Deputy Prime Minister and Levelling Up Secretary. Rachel Reeves, Britain's first female Chancellor. Pat McFadden, Labour's campaign supremo, will run the crucial cabinet office. David Lammy is now Foreign Secretary. Yvette Cooper is the Home Secretary. But it's not just those departments that will be the engine of Sir Keir's success, or otherwise, as Prime Minister. He made that much clear in his speech.
Brick by brick, we will rebuild the infrastructure of opportunity. The world-class schools and colleges, the affordable homes that I know are the ingredients of hope for working people.
That key election pledge on schools, 6,500 new teachers, is the responsibility of Bridget Phillipson, a proudly working-class woman from Sunderland and now our Education Secretary. She will also quickly, in conjunction with Ms Reeves, levy VAT on private school fees. Affordable homes, well, that's Ms Rayner's brief. Expect Labour to set the ball rolling on planning reforms within days. Other early priorities will include GB Energy, a publicly owned energy company, that'll be brought into the world by Ed Miliband, who's returning as Energy Secretary after a 14-year break. And cutting NHS waiting lists, well, that's a task for Wes Streeting as Health Secretary. That cabinet will meet for the first time tomorrow. Many will feel they need a rest after an exhausting election campaign. But Parliament is likely to sit a few weeks longer than usual before its summer break.
Henry Zerfman. So let's look more now at what went wrong with the former British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, and the Conservative Party in this election. David Gawk was a Conservative MP between 2005 and 2019. He's a former cabinet minister who fell out with his party over Brexit. He refused to accept the prospect of Britain leaving the European Union without a proper trade deal. Andrew Peach asked him for his thoughts on the polls.
I think this does go back to that period of time where the party made a decision that it was prepared to be a populist party, it was going to move to the right, it was going to make big, bold promises that were going to be very hard to deliver. And it focused much more on that than delivering sensible, competent government. And I think it's paying the price for that. And, you know, what's happened is they've ended up essentially disappointing everybody. The people who they made big promises to feel let down. Others feel that the party has moved away from them. And the combination of all of that has resulted in a disastrous defeat in this general election.
But in other countries, in Europe in particular, the process you've just described has worked well and is delivering support for political parties. So why was Britain different?
Well, it works well when you're not in government. This is the thing that, you know, the thing about populist parties is that they can do very well when they're not in office, at least appealing to a section of the electorate. But when you are in power, it becomes very hard to deliver. So the promises that are effective in winning votes are also held against you when in office.
After 14 years in power in a functioning democracy, can any political party make the case to be re-elected? Because there's always going to be this list of things that have gone wrong during their period in office. Their fault, not their fault. We could debate any particular thing on the list. But that's always going to be a problem. In fact, many countries don't even allow governments to be in power for that long for that reason.
I think you make a very fair point. It does become harder, I think, as time goes on, to be re-elected. And, you know, nobody has won more often than the Conservatives had done. And to go and win what would be a fifth general election is unprecedented in modern times. And yes, anything that happens, particularly negatively, will be held against incumbent government. There's no way you can blame your predecessors. You are held responsible for everything that happens. So, you know, along with that, you know, there are some genuine failures, I think, within the Conservative Party. It also has to be acknowledged that if you are in office for a long time, it becomes harder and harder to become re-elected. They've also had to operate, it has to be acknowledged, in difficult international circumstances with COVID, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You know, every developed country has faced issues with higher inflation and therefore a squeeze on living standards. You know, these all have come into play as well. There's been some bad luck, if you like. But I also think that the Conservative Party has to look at what it's done and the approach it's taken, its policies, its tone, and its all-round level of competence, and acknowledge that it has made some substantial mistakes itself.
Former Conservative MP David Gawk. In Scotland, where the Scottish National Party, or SNP, have run the devolved government for 17 years, Labour increased their parliamentary seats from just one to 37. Labour also did well in Wales, where Plaid Cymru won four seats. Sinn Féin have succeeded the Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, as the largest party in Northern Ireland with seven MPs, but they choose not to attend Parliament in London. For further details, check out the UK election pages on the BBC website. Let's turn to international reaction now. And President Biden has congratulated Keir Starmer on Labour's election victory. The White House said the two leaders spoke about their joint support for Ukraine in its war against Russia and their shared commitment to protecting peace in Northern Ireland. Our US State Department correspondent is Tom Bateman.
It was revealed on Air Force One in a press gaggle there that he had made that phone call to Keir Starmer to congratulate him on being appointed Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And in the short statement, the readout that they call it from the White House, we got a bit of detail about what they discussed. Some of the things you would absolutely expect to be in this kind of statement, the US talking about reaffirming the special relationship between the US and the UK. That phrase always there because they know it stimulates the importance in the UK for diplomatic reasons to feel a closeness to the United States. But on matters of substance, the major mentions there were around Ukraine, support for Ukraine, continuing that relationship, and also protecting the Good Friday Agreement. Because, of course, remember the end of the troubles, the civil conflict in the late 90s in Northern Ireland was part brokered by the US Senator George Mitchell back then. It's a subject very close to President Biden's heart because of his Irish heritage. And there was a significant mention of that. And also, I think, about protecting the fact that devolved government was restored in Northern Ireland this year. I think it's really important to the White House that there is mention of that and there is focus on that in this new Keir Starmer administration. The key moment will come next week when Mr. Starmer heads over here to Washington for the NATO summit. What the Americans will be looking for from him is an absolute commitment to keep up arms supply to Ukraine and to keep the UK's military spending at a level the US wants. And I'm not clear at the moment they're going to get an absolute guarantee about that.
Well, the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, said he was confident the new government would continue Britain's support for the alliance.
I will congratulate Keir Starmer on his election victory. I look forward to welcoming him and to meet him at the NATO summit in Washington next week. I have met also Keir Starmer here at the NATO headquarters, and I know that he's a strong supporter of NATO, of the transatlantic alliance, and also committed to ensure that the United Kingdom continues to be a strong and very committed NATO ally.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country and Britain would continue to defend their common values. In Russia, the Kremlin spokesman said Moscow was not optimistic about relations with London improving under Labour. The new British Foreign Minister, David Lammy, had this to say.
We will continue to stand with the people of Ukraine. And of course, we've got more conflicts on the globe since the Second World War and a real crisis in the Middle East. But what I am looking forward to is resetting the tone in our relationship with the European Union and our European friends. I'm also looking forward to the United Kingdom stepping up to the top table on the climate issue once more.
So, against all this background, I heard more about the new Labour government's imminent challenges on the global stage from our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
There are two that are absolutely right in front of Keir Starmer's nose, Ukraine and Gaza. On Ukraine, the British government has, for the last couple of years, been a big cheerleader for supporting Ukraine, for getting arms to Ukraine, trying to persuade the Americans to, you know, release the additional funds. And so I think Ukraine expects that to continue, and there's nothing to suggest that this will change. The Labour Party seems to share their predecessor's view that it is absolutely essential that Vladimir Putin is not allowed to win the war in Ukraine. Of course, there is a potential difficulty there. And within the next few days, Keir Starmer will be going off to a NATO summit in Washington. He'll meet Joe Biden there. He'll obviously have a chance to look at Joe Biden and assess what kind of state he is in, mentally and physically, and perhaps think forward a few months to whoever is going to be in the White House. And if that person is Donald Trump, then that whole business of being a cheerleader for Ukraine could be that much more difficult than it already is.
And we heard there David Lammy, the incoming Foreign Secretary, say that he wants to reset relations with the European Union. What does he mean by that, and how is he going to do it?
It's a little unclear what exactly he means, but the Labour Party has talked about a new EU-UK security pact, has talked about exploring ways, short of going back into the EU, which they've absolutely ruled out, but ways to improve and deepen the relationship with European partners. But again, potentially there are difficulties there, because on Sunday in France, we may have a complete shift of government in that country. If the right takes over, if Marine Le Pen's party takes over, then all sorts of things that the Labour Party might want to do with our European partners, particularly with France, could be that much more difficult. Think about cooperation on migration, for example. And for Britain to have any any influence on the international stage, it needs alliances and relationships.
You talk about influence on the international stage. The last time the Labour government got in 1997, they were a significantly more potent force on the international stage, weren't they?
They were, and arguably Britain was. And, you know, some people would say that it's a slow, steady decline from, you know, post-imperial Britain to where we are today. Britain is not a major player. And that is why these relationships are so important. And of course, there are umpteen other challenges, arguably climate change being the biggest, the relationship with China. And that relationship is a very, very difficult one. You know, foreign policy didn't come up in the election campaign. Gaza didn't come up in the election campaign. But it did cost Labour four seats, four candidates who ran as independents, largely because of their unhappiness with what they saw as the Labour Party's unwillingness to endorse a call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Now, the Labour Party did adjust subsequently, but it paid a price. And Gaza is one of those subjects and the wider Middle East peace process, which will again need to be grappled with and potentially soon.
Paul Adams. As we heard, President Biden was travelling on Air Force One on Friday. He went to a campaign rally in the state of Wisconsin. There, the 81-year-old president told supporters that he isn't too old for a second term in office. He also referred to his widely criticised performance in last week's TV debate against Donald Trump.
Now, you probably heard we had a little debate last week. Can't say it was my best performance.
We love you, Trump.
But ever since then, there's been a lot of speculation. What's Joe going to do? Is he going to stay in the race? Is he going to drop out? What's he going to do? Well, here's my answer. I am running and going to win again.
Well, our correspondent Mike Wendling was at the rally in Wisconsin. He says President Biden was in a confident mood.
It seems like there's almost two Joe Bidens. There's the rally Joe Biden, and then there's the debate Joe Biden. And today we saw the rally Joe Biden. He was in front of a crowd of supporters. They were very enthusiastic. They were lapping it up. He was on good form book for nearly 20 minutes. And, you know, the diehard Democrats in the audience really gave him a round of applause, particularly when he went after Donald Trump, a theme that he has returned to again and again. He says that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy.
Mike Wendling. Counting is underway in Iran after the second round of voting in the presidential election. The final results will be announced on Saturday, and there seems to have been a surge in the turnout on Friday after millions boycotted the polls in the first round a week ago amidst widespread discontent. This time, state television showed voters queuing in several cities, although conflicting reports said the polling stations remained relatively empty. I spoke to Kazra Naji of BBC Persian just before recording this podcast. He told me about some early indications of a result.
A news agency close to the Revolutionary Guard, Tasnim News Agency, has just reported that early counts of the votes show that the relatively moderate candidate, Masoud Pezeshkian, is ahead in the counts. So that's the latest, and it's unofficial. We haven't heard from the officials yet. It's the second round of the elections, and as you said, there are indications that in the second round, more people turned out to vote out of fear that if they don't vote, the conservative candidate, Saeed Jalili, will be elected, and he's from the most hard-line conservative faction in the Islamic Republic.
Would the government like and require a high turnout anyway? Because otherwise it looks as though the election is illegitimate.
Absolutely. In the first round, the turnout was just below 40%, which was the lowest since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And for a regime that claims to be based on popular masses that led a revolution, less than 40% turnout doesn't look too good. Of course, they want a higher turnout, but as you said, many people boycotted the elections. They didn't want to have anything to do with it because they basically think it's not possible within the system for any president to have any meaningful impact on in the direction the country is going to take.
And if it does turn out that this moderate candidate has won, what difference would it make for Iranians?
Well, this is it. The choice is between a little bit of change compared to Iran going back to dark ages.
Going back to the dark ages in what sense?
As I say, Mr. Jalili is from the most hardline factions within the Islamic Republic. And these people, if they do come to power, many people, in fact, fear that there will be a lot more confrontation with the outside world. And internally, Iran is going to be more isolated and under a lot more sanctions.
Kazra Naji of BBC Persian. Still to come, the Vatican announces the excommunication of an archbishop after finding him guilty of schism, or splitting the church. Just a few days into his six-month term at the helm of the Council of the European Union, the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, is already making waves on the world stage. On Tuesday, he met Ukraine's President Zelensky in Kyiv to put forward proposals for a ceasefire with Russia. And on Friday, he was in Moscow to meet President Putin. Mr. Orban is the EU's only head of national government to maintain warm ties with Russia since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. European leaders have now openly condemned the Moscow trip. The European Commission spokesman is Eric Mamer.
It is clear that whatever the messaging around the trip from the Hungarians and from Prime Minister Orban, the substance of this trip is not the right one. This is about appeasement. It's not about peace. And we believe that it undermines the unity and determination that we need to show in order for this war to end.
So what should we make of this visit? I've been talking to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, in Moscow.
I mean, the whole story is quite extraordinary, isn't it? Because just, you know, less than a week into the Hungarian presidency, you have Viktor Orban making this surprise visit to Moscow and the EU saying, well, look, we didn't give you a mandate to go there, and all this talk about appeasement. The view from Moscow, if you speak to the Hungarian delegation, as we did earlier in the Kremlin, they say, this is not appeasement, this is dialogue. We have to restore dialogue with the Russians, they say, if we want to resolve the Ukraine conflict. They completely reject the accusation. But after 3 hours of talks with the Russians, was there a breakthrough? It doesn't seem to have been a breakthrough. President Putin and Prime Minister Orban came out, made statements to a group of journalists. We were there. And President Putin, his position hadn't seemed to have changed one little bit. He kept talking about his so-called peace plan, peace initiative, which he presented a few weeks ago, which is widely seen not as a peace plan, but as an ultimatum, basically saying that Ukraine has to pull its troops out of the Donbass and regions which Russia has partially occupied, and also out of areas which are under Ukrainian control now. This is seen as really as an attempt to get Ukraine to capitulate.
So, Steve, if nothing of substance came out of this visit, what about diplomatically for President Putin? He has been isolated from pretty much the whole of Europe since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. What did President Putin get out of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And really, the Russians will have been well aware of the optics here. The fact that there is a leader of a European country, a country which, you know, has now taken over the six-month rotating presidency of the EU, getting on a plane, flying to Moscow, to the Kremlin, to sit down for talks with Vladimir Putin. This allows the Russian authorities to say, we're not isolated at all. We have European leaders coming to talk to us. And this, of course, is dominating the news bulletins here in Russia. So Russia can use this for its benefit. There's no doubt about that. And you know, I often get the feeling that the Russian authorities like to look for any opportunity they can to drive wedges between their opponents. You know, looking at Europe, they try to befriend certain leaders. They look for ways to spread division and disunity, and I think they've spotted an opportunity here.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia. 10 days ago, parts of the parliamentary compound in the Kenyan capital Nairobi were in flames. people protesting about proposed tax rises had broken in, ransacking rooms. The security forces responded with live fire. At least 13 people were killed across the city. The president, William Ruto, withdrew the controversial tax reforms, and now he's taken to social media to speak directly to the young Kenyans who were involved in the protests. It was a live session on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, joined the president's online meeting.
It is a fast in almost any country. The president engaging with citizens on social media platforms and taking direct, raw and often hard-hitting questions. But it had several false starts and began an hour late.
Sorry, gentlemen, about technology has its own challenges, but I hope I'm audible. I'm very happy to be here. I acceded to the request of many young people who said I should come to X and have an engagement with them so that I can do the most important thing I have been accused of not doing.
The president had addressed the nation on national media following 2 weeks of deadly protests. But the young Kenyans who had organized themselves online before going to the streets wanted him to meet them where they are, on social media. They were angry and disappointed at the government. Do we really matter as people who elected you? Asked a cameraman who witnessed the killing of a protester outside parliament. Have you reached out to any family member? Asked another ex-user. The often direct and sharp-shooting president apologized for not showing empathy before and promised to listen more to Kenyans.
I am immensely grateful for the feedback, immense feedback I have got on X. In fact, I think I took a long time before coming to X. I think I should be more often in this X space to engage with you guys and to deal with situation there. Listening to the feedback today on X, I think I have gone home with, I need to listen more. I need more empathy. And my administration needs more empathy. And I have had you say loudly, more action.
The online meeting lasted over 2 hours. Participants peaked at 163,000 with millions of views hours later. It has no doubt changed the governance conversation in Kenya.
That was Anne Soy. The Vatican has announced the excommunication of an archbishop who's known to be a critic of Pope Francis after finding him guilty of schism or splitting the church. The office in charge of enforcing church discipline said Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano had refused to submit to the Pope. Will Vernon has more details.
Archbishop Vigano, he's accused of refusing to recognise the legitimacy of church bodies and even of Pope Francis himself. The Archbishop is a controversial figure who's appeared at far-right rallies in the US and publicly criticises papal policies on LGBT people and migrants. He has previously called for Pope Francis to resign. Vigano also accuses the Pope of covering up child abuse, which the Vatican denies.
Will Vernon, now back to our main story. Hours after his Labour Party was swept to office with a massive electoral majority, Britain's new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, on Friday assembled his senior government team. So, who exactly is Keir Starmer? With this profile of him is our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
I will lead this great party into a new era with confidence and with hope, so that when the time comes, we can serve our country again in government.
It was barely 4 years ago that Sir Keir Starmer became Labour leader in the middle of the COVID pandemic and after the party's crushing defeat under the hard left leadership of Jeremy Corbyn at the last general election. So who is the man who has pulled off this extraordinary political turnaround, and what, if anything, is Starmerism? By the standards of British Prime Ministers, the 61-year-old Keir Starmer comes from a fairly ordinary background. The son of a factory worker and a nurse, he grew up in Surrey, south of London, where childhood friend Paul Vickers has this memory of the young Keir and his home.
I used to love going there. It was always like a building site. And there were holes in the wall, there was bits of masonry missing. It was always as though they were trying to finish the house, but never actually got quite around to completing the job. Keir was always up to something, whether it was football, practicing an instrument in the house, It was a very joyful house. There was always shouting. It was very energetic.
Keir Starmer was the first in his family to go to university, studying law at Leeds and then Oxford before becoming a successful human rights lawyer, often defending those accused of terrorism and extremism, earning him the lefty lawyer label from his political opponents. But the defender turned prosecutor, ending up as head of the government's entire prosecution service in 2008.
Keir Starmer, Labour Party, 29,062.
Although always interested in politics and a man of the left, it wasn't until relatively late in his career that he became an elected politician in 2015. As to his true political beliefs, there have been accusations he is a man of little faith, someone who passionately supported Remain, but now says Brexit must be made to work, and who once backed Jeremy Corbyn before kicking him out of the party. Apparently unbothered by such allegations of ideological drift, Starmer defines his politics pragmatically as a mission to help ordinary families like his own.
That determination to change things for the better, and by which I mean the living standards of families across the country, families like my family when I was growing up, to give them what I've always called the ordinary hope that particularly working class families want. That's what stirs me, to reach that place, to change their lives, to have that opportunity.
Despite his extraordinary success, polling suggests he remains personally unloved. Speaking before the election campaign, the commentator Rachel Sylvester, an admirer of Starmer's, thinks it's partly because he doesn't give much away about his feelings or his politics.
I think because he had quite a sort of tough upbringing in a way, he's not immediately open-spirited, empathetic kind of person. He comes across, I think, probably to most people as decent. They can imagine him on the steps of Number 10, but they're not quite sure what he stands for still.
What we do know about Keir Starmer outside politics is that he loves football, both playing it still and watching it, and music, and that family life, his wife and two children, are key. Indeed, in a BBC interview last year, he said protecting his family would be his biggest concern, not running the country.
I'm really not daunted about the difficult decisions we'll have to make in government if we get that far. I am worried about my children. That is probably the single thing that does keep me awake as to how we will protect them through this.
In the same interview, he had an interesting insight into how the country had changed from when Labour last won in 1997 under Tony Blair, after a long period of Conservative government, and now. Then it was all cool Britannia and things can only get better. Now the mood is bleaker and people less trusting.
I think there's a real sense of concern, of insecurity, and people want a Labour Party, and if we're privileged enough to serve, a Labour government, to weld together the reassurance that they need with the hope that things can change. And it's a different mood, and we have to get that absolutely spot on.
These are indeed gloomier times, but then that also means no one is expecting Mr. Starmer to be like Tony Blair or to work miracles.
Rob Watson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Stephen Bailey. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.